Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. As the UK pushes ahead with its mass COVID inoculation program, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's trying to reassure the public over the effectiveness of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. A study's found it provides minimal protection against mild and moderate cases of the South African variant of the virus. But Mr. Johnson points out both jabs being rolled out protect against death and serious illness, and he says that's what matters most. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley.
The British capital is in the depths of winter. That's the sound of snow crunching underfoot. Across the country, people are braving the cold to receive their first COVID-19 jabs. And Boris Johnson insists they should not be put off by research showing the Oxford-AstraZeneca jab may give limited protection against mild cases of the South African variant of the disease.
We believe that our vaccines are effective in combating a serious disease and death against all variants. But the most important thing is that the vaccinologists, the scientists, are getting ever faster and more expert in coming up with the new vaccines and the variants of the vaccines, if you like, that enable us to defeat the virus.
The small study of around 2,000 people found the jab may only be 10% effective against the variant, but scientists say it's still likely to stop deaths and hospitalisations. Only 147 cases of the South African variant have been identified in the UK so far, although there is concern the figure could be higher. Scientists are working around the clock to modify the vaccine, and there are already plans to give millions of people booster jabs later this year. The British Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, says the vaccination take-up has been higher than expected, with more than 90% of those over 70 agreeing to be inoculated.
We have now, as of today, vaccinated more than 12.2 million people. That's almost one in four of all adults across the United Kingdom.
The World Health Organization says the study is concerning, but manufacturers will need to continually adjust vaccines as the virus evolves. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
A week of relative calm within the federal government over the Prime Minister's stated preference to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 has given way to outright hostility among members of the Nationals. One senator is threatening to cross the floor, even though no legislation is expected to be put to Parliament. But a demand from the Nationals leader, Michael McCormick, to exempt agriculture from any carbon reduction target appears to be at odds with the intentions of the nation's peak farming body. Political reporter David Lipson has more.
A video put out by Meat and Livestock Australia.
We have numerous pathways to reduce emissions.
It features sheep grazing amid wind turbines, because even this sector, which produces one of the world's more troublesome greenhouse gases in the form of methane, is committed to net zero emissions by 2030.
We as an industry will take the lead, and we don't need the heavy hand of regulation.
Farmers, it seems, are increasingly aware of the impact of climate change and prepared to work toward a carbon-neutral future. But the political party that bills itself as standing for regional Australia in federal parliament is again showing hostility to any such intent.
Look, I don't think we should be signing up to this mythical target in any case.
National Senator Matt Canavan says he's willing to cross the floor on any net zero target.
I'm opposed to it holes bolts, because it was shut down coal mines, it was shut down factories, it would shift our jobs over to China more.
The government's not pushing to legislate a target. The Prime Minister's only spoken of a preference to achieve net zero by 2050. But after a week of tacit acceptance within the government, resistance among the junior coalition partner appears to be hardening. Nationals leader, Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormick, is advocating an exemption for agriculture.
Absolutely, that may well have to be on the table.
And possibly manufacturing and mining too, if a target impacts on Australians living outside of major cities.
Whether they're in mines, whether they're on farms, whether they're in factories,
They don't want that factory or that farm to have to close to meet some goal that's put in place to achieve an outcome in 2050.
When you say it may well have to be on the table, is that something the Nationals are demanding?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, we could very well have to have a caveat like New Zealand has.
That's not the way the National Farmers Federation sees it. The peak body for agriculture has committed to reaching net zero emissions by 2050. And CEO Tony Maher made clear in a statement, agriculture is too important to leave out of any national climate target and too important to ignore.
Any policy that restricts opportunities available to farmers and rural and regional communities would clearly be a negative outcome.
Michael McCormack again.
Oh, look, I talk to Tony Maher all the time, but I also talk to farmers toiling the soil.
The National Farmers seem to be saying that they don't want to be carved out. They want to be included in a net zero future.
And well done to them. And we can work with them. There's all sorts of things.
Does that mean that they're working or you're working at cross purposes to each other?
No, not at all.
Is there an internal revolt happening in the Nationals over this government policy?
Not at all.
That's the Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack ending David Lipson's report. Australia's denied it's trying to interfere in China's legal system after Beijing demanded the federal government stop interfering in its investigation of Australian journalist Cheng Lei. China announced yesterday it had formally arrested the Australian journalist. She's been detained for 6 months. She's accused of supplying state secrets, though no specific charges have yet been laid. The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, told AM Australia's not interfering and still hasn't seen any evidence. The minister joined me earlier. Minister, good morning and welcome to AM. China claims advocacy for Ms. Cheng amounts to interference, and it's asked Australia to stop interfering in its judicial system. Are you interfering?
Sabra, Australia will always stand up for the interests of our citizens in the circumstances in which they find themselves. Ms. Cheng was detained in August of last year and has been formally arrested in the last couple of days. And it is entirely appropriate for Australia to observe that she deserves the basic standards of justice, procedural fairness and humane treatment to be met in accordance with international norms. That doesn't constitute interference with the Chinese legal system. And in fact, I have said on previous occasions when similar matters, including in relation to Ms. Cheng, have been raised, that of course we respect the Chinese legal system as we do legal systems in other countries.
It could be another 7 months before charges are actually laid. Her two children are apparently very distraught. China's allegations against Ms. Cheng, has Australia requested or even seen the evidence supporting its claims?
Australia is not privy to that evidence. The details of the formal arrest have only just been released, and of course the criminal investigation is now underway in accordance with those Chinese legal processes. But I do want to absolutely acknowledge the extremely difficult time this is for her family. We are very aware of that. Our consular officers are engaged with her family, as you would expect, and we will continue to provide support to them as we provide support to Ms. Cheng.
Australian officials last saw her about a week ago via CCTV. That's my understanding. What can you say about her health and the conditions she's being detained?
Sabra, we have been able to visit her approximately monthly in recent times in accordance with the bilateral consular agreement. There is, of course, no question that these are very difficult and distressing circumstances for her. These are difficult times. She is naturally concerned, as anyone would be, about her family and about her own situation. So we will endeavour to continue to provide that consular support as we are able to, and to provide that to her family and ensure that within the confines of our privacy expectations, or requirements rather, that we are doing that.
Given what's happened to her and Australian writer Yung Heng Jun, is China's treatment designed to curtail criticism and silence it?
Well, I'm not going to speculate really on whether it's an approach that is the approach that China is taking. I'm not sure that that's necessarily helpful. But the most important thing that we can do is to support those citizens, both Dr. Yung and Ms. Cheng, and provide every level of consular support in these very difficult circumstances.
In Myanmar, and to the detention of the Australian economist Professor Sean Turnell at a police facility, his family is extremely worried, and Australia has said that military cooperation with Myanmar is at risk. You've asked for his immediate release. What's happened?
We have asked for his immediate release, and we have been in contact with the most senior levels of the incoming government in Myanmar. It's obviously a very volatile situation. Unfortunately, we also saw the use of water cannon in Naypyidaw overnight. And we are joining with a number of countries in our region, ASEAN in particular. I've been in contact last night with the Indonesian foreign minister and late last week with the current chair of ASEAN, my colleague in Brunei, in relation to these issues. We are working very hard to secure the release of Dr. Turnell, Professor Turnell. He is a very, very well-respected academic. His passion has been in helping Myanmar and the people of Myanmar, as his family has related in their statement overnight.
Well, if there is no response to releasing him, how quickly will Australia make a decision about its response?
Well, we are working across government. We have a number of avenues of engagement with Myanmar, but it is, as I said, very volatile. It is difficult for many in Yangon and in Naypyidaw to obtain access to senior government representatives. That is a key focus for our officials there, as well as, of course, the welfare of Dr. Turnell and other Australians who are also in Myanmar at this time. But these issues are ones which are very, very pressing. We want to ensure that he is as safe as possible, and I am very focused on seeking his release.
As you pointed out, water cannon have been used overnight. People continue to turn out and protest. The military has imposed a curfew overnight, and it says it will hold new elections and hand over power. How acceptable is that?
We are very concerned, Sabra. There's no question. I think the Prime Minister expressed Australia's deep disappointment last week when he spoke to you and your colleagues at the National Press Club. In this context, we have to find a path through to work with representatives in Myanmar at this point in time to ensure that we are able to speak with the government, we are able to advocate on behalf of Australian citizens such as Professor Turnell, and to provide support to them and to others. We'll continue to do that. But we do encourage the government in Myanmar to respect the rule of law and, of course, also to ensure communications access so that there is transparency and there is openness. It's not just Australia who is calling for this. The UN Security Council has resolved on this matter and many, many of our international counterparts seek the same.
Minister, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thank you very much, Sabra.
The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne. Some alarming trends in the emerging and growing threats to kids online have been highlighted in a survey of teens' digital lives. There's been an uptick in the complaints about cyberbullying and online predators. Perhaps more troubling is that much of that and the unwanted content is invisible to parents. So the eSafety Commissioner is ramping up cyber safety awareness with a new campaign to start the chat. Emily Burke reports.
For Australian teenagers, being online is an essential part of life. But for this senior student in Melbourne's northwest, the risks are also par for the course.
And I have my account on private on all of my social media.
Have you had any negative experiences?
Some bullying in that I've been asked for nudes in that and I have declined them because I just don't think that's acceptable. But it's kind of just normal, as much as I hate to say it.
Our children are growing up where this is the norm.
Melbourne mum Rochelle has two teenagers and she's also a teacher in the southeastern suburbs.
Different apps that they're using now, which are more anonymous, where people can come in and say nasty things and bullying starts to start happening. And I didn't actually realise that these apps actually existed until my daughter was telling me this just last week.
A survey of more than 620 Australian teenagers found, perhaps unsurprisingly, the use of technology is extensive.
They don't really distinguish between their on and offline lives.
Julie Inman-Grant is Australia's eSafety Commissioner.
30% experienced unwanted contact by a stranger online, and also in terms of receiving receiving inappropriate material that could be pornography, unsolicited intimate images or violent content that these kids can't unsee.
Toby Dagg is head of investigations at the Office of the eSafety Commissioner. He says there's been a doubling of complaints to the agency in the past 12 months.
And about a third of all reports made to us about image-based abuse are made by children and young people. And we see requests for nudes, sometimes very aggressive requests, can be made in very brazen ways, right through to very sophisticated long-term grooming efforts that use social engineering techniques.
But there's an even more sinister trend on the rise.
Children being encouraged remotely to perform sexual acts for the camera, and often our investigators can hear the parents' voices in the next room. And this is why we believe that parents are the front line of defence.
But not all teens are calling out the bad behaviour.
Some said they would just ignore it, 40%. 30% said that they didn't think it was serious enough. And 20% didn't think that anything would change. Now, to me, that's the most concerning statistic, because children don't have to suffer in silence. They don't have to manage this alone.
And that's Julie Inman-Grant, Australia's eSafety Commissioner, and she was speaking with Emily Burke. Rain and cooler weather have brought blessed relief for firefighters who spent the bulk of last week battling a massive bushfire northeast of Perth. Much of the region's been downgraded to an advice level or even given the all clear. But as the smoke clears and the clean-up begins, the affected communities know it'll be many months, perhaps even years, before they recover from the devastation. Our reporter, Bridget Fitzgerald, has been visiting the area and speaking with residents.
It's one of those sites that's really difficult to comprehend until you see it. Melted and twisted corrugated iron, charred and burnt out appliances, a pile of debris. But just 8 days ago, this was Jessica Blackwell's home.
So yeah, there were some steps here up to the house as well, and some steps just there where the little L bit is. Yeah, and there's, you know, melted stuff everywhere, really. And some of it I can't work out what it was. Rubble and tin. Yeah. That's about it.
How are you feeling at the moment? Have you been able to process what's happened?
No, not at all. I think I'm in complete denial, actually. I look at it and I can't even recognise it as my house, and I think it's not sinking in properly yet.
Any sense of normalcy will take some time. The fire burnt through 11,000 hectares. Jessica Blackwell's place is one of more than 80 homes lost, many of which were in this community of Tilden Park on the edge of Gidgee-Gannup, around 40 k's northeast of Perth. Even for those whose houses were saved, it won't be an easy road. Fences, pasture and sheds were lost. Hundreds of power lines are down. More than 400 homes will remain without power for several weeks. Melody Semler lives just down the road.
It went around our street. So if you look on the fire map, you'll see the area is untouched. There's one property at the bottom, which you can see from here, that dam paddock, which is burnt out. I can stand on my deck at home and I can't tell there's been a fire at all. It's unbelievable how, just drive down my street 500 metres down the road, suddenly it's like a war zone. It's horrifying, absolutely horrifying.
Currently, the recovery efforts on the immediate issues, clean water, generators for power, feed for animals and clearing blocks. The recovery is being coordinated by the State Emergency Management Committee, which will respond to further issues in the weeks and months ahead. Huddled under an umbrella, looking at the wreck of her house as the rain begins to fall, Jessica Blackwell doesn't hesitate when I ask her if she'll rebuild.
Yeah, we will come back here. The community, it's such a good community to live in. You know, it doesn't look like the area that we wanted to move to anymore. The people are still the same.
It's Tilden Park resident Jessica Blackwell, and she was speaking with AM's Bridget Fitzgerald there. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.